The Holy Gospel according to St. Matthew, the 13th chapter.
Glory to you, Lord.
He put before them another parable. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to someone who sowed good seed in his field, but while everybody was asleep, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and then went away. So, when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared as well. And the slaves of the householder came and said to him, "Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where then did these weeds come from?" He answered, "An enemy has done this." The slave said to him, "Then do you want us to go and gather them?" But he replied, "No. For in gathering the weeds, you would uproot the wheat along with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest. And at harvest time, I will tell the reapers, 'Collect the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" Then he left the crowds and went into the house, and his disciples approached him, saying, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field." He answered, "The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed are the children of the kingdom. The weeds are the children of the evil one, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are collected and burned up with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will collect out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all evildoers, and they will throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Let anyone with ears listen." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
Please be seated. I'm thinking about hiring a literary agent for my new novel, Blood in the Sacristy. I'm sorry, it was just there to be done. But a couple of words about the sermon before the sermon. First, I'll be running pretty close to the text from Romans 8 from time to time, if you want to keep that in front of you. And second, it's a real privilege to be asked to speak on this topic of race in our educational system. It's a topic to which I've devoted a good deal of my own professional energy over quite a period of time. We have in religious studies the Wabash Center that sponsors teaching and learning in theology and religion, and I participated in a workshop there on teaching in racially and culturally diverse classrooms. With the Wabash Center and the Society of Biblical Literature, I've been involved in training other biblical scholars to teach in diverse classrooms. And let's just say it directly, I'm still learning and find my own shortcomings day after day. Well, remember banks that were too big to fail? Well, then again, we still have those, don't we? So maybe I could try a different direction. Have you ever faced a problem too big to solve? It happens. Somebody here has loved a life partner, really loved them, but after years, perhaps many years, you found yourself stuck in the same deadly cycles of conversation. You looked for help, you tried to change things, but it just seemed those patterns ran so deep that nothing you could do would ever change them. You've been there. Somebody here has lost control of his health or her health. Somebody's tried a new diet or picked up exercise or meditation just to be healthy, but one New Year's resolution has crashed after another. One more gym membership has expired. One pair of sneakers ran out of fashion before they were worn out. One optimistic pants purchase never quite got worn. Somebody here has had to reinvent himself or herself professionally. The old job ran into a dead end. Perhaps an employer was headed downhill. And years into a career, having made one's own way in the world and taken care of oneself, you found yourself unprepared. to live in a strange new world, and it just seemed like too much. Relationships, health, vocations, it happens. Things grow too big for simple analysis or easy problem solving. We need help. We need to get beyond ourselves somehow. The Apostle Paul puts it this way: we groan within ourselves, waiting for our final redemption. We know the spirit of slavery, but we seek the spirit of belonging. And Paul goes cosmic. It's not just about us as individuals. It's the whole creation groaning, laboring like a woman about to give birth. I saw that, scared the pants off me. All of creation seeking liberation from the powers that bind and frustrate it. All of creation seeking freedom, a freedom that ultimately comes only from God. So, brothers and sisters, Paul writes, we are debtors, not to live according to the flesh, but if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you'll live. The problem of race in America is like that. Race goes all the way down to our roots. European settlers entered the land. Both accidentally and on purpose, their expansion created the conditions of genocide, decimating native populations, some entirely, displacing all of them. The history is ugly. It's unavoidable. If our nation was founded in the desire for freedom, it was just as much founded in death. Almost as soon as Europeans settled villages, they began to import slaves. More slaves in the South, but slaves all over. Millions upon millions of Africans rounded up, died in transit, dumped into the ocean, sold in markets, counted in our Constitution as 3/5 of a legal person. Our national heritage includes a legacy of freedom and this legacy of death. We still live with both legacies, and they manifest themselves in deep, complicated ways. For what? For what is creation longing when it comes to race and education? How will God bring life and freedom where slavery and death have exerted such influence? And we are so easily distracted, aren't we? So easily distracted. Just recently, Donald Sterling, the billionaire owner of basketball's Los Angeles Clippers, was caught uttering vile, racist words to his girlfriend. Many of you caught the story, didn't you? Having been sued multiple times for racial discrimination in his business practices, Sterling got himself in really hot water publicly by telling his girlfriend, "It bothers me a lot that you want to broadcast that you're associating with black people. The little I ask you is not to bring them to my games." Big news for days and weeks. And how easily we were distracted. The legal maneuvers continue, of course, don't they always? But UCLA has just rejected Sterling's $3 million gift, which might help him pay the $2.5 million fine he owes professional basketball. He may no longer so much as visit his team's training facilities or an NBA game ever again. And we get distracted. A basketball team turns its warm-ups inside out before the game to protest one hateful man's spiteful comments, and the sports media goes nuts for weeks. We got a racist. Right here, we got a racist. Oh my gosh, racism. Can you believe it? How gullible we can be. I'll share my own hypocrisy. God help me, I love Southern football. And in the Southeastern Conference, I love Auburn. You did that first time, Gus. Last set of numbers I saw, Auburn was graduating 100% of their college football players. The white ones. Most of the players are black, and 44% of them graduate. That gets almost no attention. In the Southeastern Conference, where by far most players are black, where many assistant coaches are black because you can't recruit African American players without African American coaches. Of 14 teams, 2 head coaches are black. Maybe you need black assistant coaches to recruit players. Maybe it's thought you need white head coaches to cultivate donors. We're so easily distracted. We get all upset when one white person says something offensive that it keeps us from looking at the big picture, a picture in which educational and employment outcomes for minorities lag far, far behind those of whites. We get upset over individual cases, but in the world of education, we refuse to ask the hard questions, the questions that might reveal the true nature of things, the questions that might demand change. We're talking today about racism in the educational world, and let's be honest, it is a most vexing subject. At one level, we all know the basics. African Americans and Latinos, Latinas experience far worse overall educational outcomes than do white Americans and Asian Americans. At every level, readiness for school, passing elementary school proficiency exams, completing high school, completing college, representation in college and university faculties, promotion to tenured academic ranks. At every level, there's a strong correlation between race and results. And of course, we know, and the statisticians will remind us, that correlation does not imply causation. In other words, just because many minorities experience relatively negative outcomes, that doesn't mean that race necessarily explains the problem. Maybe it's something else, like economics or geography. Surely, we're not saying that teachers and administrators are racist who seek to exclude black and brown people from educational attainment. And that's how we allow ourselves to be distracted. The Donald Sterlings of the world look like real racists, but racism is not about people who say mean things. Racism is not about people who harass minorities or pass out hate literature. Racism isn't even really about racists. It's not about individuals, not primarily. Racism is about society. It's about how we build a world. We're constantly building and rebuilding our world in ways that time after time, intentionally or unintentionally, place some minorities at huge disadvantages. Those things happen because of choices we make that have enormous consequences. And when we make those choices, we may not be thinking about race. But the outcomes have racist implications just the same, over and over again. Last week, Professor Hetrick apologized for turning to statistics, and I'll hope her apology will cover me this Sunday. I'll just try to stay brief with them. But preparing for this sermon, I learned that black and brown students attend schools with higher concentrations of first-year teachers than white students do. That on average, African American and Hispanic high school seniors perform at the same grade level as 13-year-old white students. That in 6 years, over 60% of white students graduate college, but just over 40% of black students do, less than 40% in state universities. I took a random unscientific sample, but unbiased, of Millersville University's website, visited the sites for English, sociology, and early childhood education, and looked at the pictures of faculty members. 26 faculty photos in English. I thought I saw 3 minorities, 1 African American and 2 Asian American. What are the chances English students are reading a lot of Toni Morrison at Millersville? 15 in sociology and anthropology, 1 each, Hispanic, African American, and Asian American. 18 in early childhood education, 2 Hispanic, married couple, 1 black. How much research is going on at Millersville, I wonder, that likely applies to city schools like Lancaster, York, Reading, and Harrisburg? And studies show that white students, this study's been done over and over again, white students repeatedly provide more negative teaching evaluations for minority faculty members, which directly affects things like promotion to tenure and rank and compensation. And as a Southerner, I have to say, Lancaster County is one of the most segregated places I've ever lived. I mean, we have a county population that's over 90% white and a city population that's just over 50% white. A slight majority of the high school students in the city are Puerto Rican, but much like cities like Memphis, Birmingham, Richmond, we have segregated schools in Lancaster County. White kids in the suburbs with just a few kids of color, black and brown kids in the city school with some white kids. And it's a pattern that's happening all over the United States. In many parts of our country, research shows, our public schools are growing more, not less, segregated. And that's surely enough statistics. They have their place, but they only tell so much. My point is that race may not cause all those disparities. People are not choosing to make racist choices, but race is surely part of the problem we have to analyze. Individual racists don't create these disparities, but our repeated, predictable social choices bear these race-related outcomes. And what do we say about all this in the light of the gospel? There's no denying the effects of race in our educational system from preschool to graduate school, and yet few of us consider ourselves racist. In other words, we have a complicated problem. The solutions we're trying don't seem to be working. And meanwhile, the United States falls farther and farther behind our peer nations in educating our citizens. Where does a Christian go in the midst of such vexing challenges? Our passage in Romans 8, I hope, suggests some clues. Paul has been reflecting on how Jesus liberates believers from what he calls the law of sin and death, those impersonal powers that have a way of pulling us into frustration and despondency. I'd like to reflect on three items that speak to the challenges we face briefly, and then a couple of suggestions that apply particularly to those of us who are white. So first, Paul acknowledges the frustration of our fallen world. It exceeds language. It transcends analysis. All creation, he writes, suffers frustration and slavery. All creation lives with the pain that causes, that comes from this frustration. Whether it's race or climate change or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, our world includes this level of frustration that often eludes our best efforts. And the frustration would tempt us to give up, but it's real. If we want to live into the world that God is creating, we may have to acknowledge that things just could be more complicated than we like to imagine, that solutions aren't so simple, that a certain humility is a good thing when it comes to Christian citizenship in a complicated world. Second, believers are called to live outside the familiar frameworks of society. To use Paul's words, we're called to live not by the flesh, but by the Spirit. The flesh is all about asserting our strength. The flesh is all about promoting our privilege. But the Spirit is about life and freedom. Life, Paul says, resides in the Spirit. Life in the Spirit takes a critical look at the flesh. Ordinarily, we just slide into our relationships without really thinking about them much. But life in the Spirit calls for examination. If we live in a lily-white neighborhood, might we not ask, how'd that happen? And what are its implications? How does my living in this neighborhood relate to following Christ? If all our social partners are white, should we be asking, what does this mean? Is Christ's body a white body? And if not, what kind of social life should I live? The ways of the Spirit undermine the conventional wisdom of the flesh. And third, God can handle our confusion. One of my favorite verses in all of Scripture comes in Romans 8:26. Things can be so complicated, Paul writes, we don't even know how to pray as we ought. We don't know what to do. We don't know how to pray. And then the Holy Spirit intercedes with God on our behalf. In size, Paul writes, too deep for words. We don't have to know the answers. We don't have to get everything right. But we can open ourselves to the Spirit and offer our world to God in prayer. Friends, race disparities constitute a political and social issue, yes, but they also embody a gospel issue. Christ's body has many shades of skin. When one part of the body enjoys prosperity while the rest languishes in inferiority and hopelessness, Christ's body suffers harm. Too often we, all of us, myself as much as anyone, latch our imaginations to our own circle, to folks like us. And yet Christian testimony implies seeking health and freedom for all of God's children. So a couple of things we can do, especially those of us who are white. First, we can be honest and check our privilege. A lot of us have worked hard for our success, so we think we somehow earned where we are in life. When I was in seminary, I worked 3 jobs at a time. I unloaded air freight, coached football, worked in a psych hospital, served a church. I can win any bar bet for the worst jobs one has had paying one's way through school, and I can go 3 deep. But you know what? Because I was white, I had so many advantages that many of my childhood friends lacked. My grandparents were poor, but they owned land. Not many non-white people were owning land in my grandparents' generation. Sunday school teachers hooked me up for jobs or wrote recommendations to colleges and even fraternities. A friend's dad, also white, bought my gym membership to help prepare me for football, and playing football helped me get the scholarship that paid my way through college. And one of my white coaches nominated me for a summer studies program in Europe that helped me find my path into academics. And white professors took extra time to teach me Greek or mentor me with my honors project, even when they were on leave, and they didn't get paid for it. People looked out for me all my life in ways that my black friends did not receive. And here I am. Worked hard for it, but I didn't do it myself. What about you? Sometimes, friends, the most important thing we can do, especially those of us who are white, is to sit down and listen. That's the second thing. So often our media wants to tell us what minorities need. The talking heads tell us what other people should be doing. And because many of us lack real open relationships with persons of color, we just let that spin in our own imaginations. When we don't know what to say, when we don't know how to pray, maybe it's time to turn off Fox News and MSNBC and just have lunch with a new friend. What do they want for their children and their grandchildren? What are the obstacles they face? What are things really like in parts of our society that we don't see? And in those conversations, might we find what is the way of the Spirit for all of us? Amen.